And, yeah, at least at my understanding of it. So they were sort of pilgrims in 1608 from certain congregation of rebellion. And now we have 400th anniversary of it. So the Mayflower Autonomous Ship, or MAS, which is driven by artificial intelligence, launched from Plymouth in UK in September 2020, and is in voyage to mark 400th anniversary of the Pilgrim ship, which brought European settlers to American land in 1620. IBM was providing artificial intelligence system for the ship. It is kind of political because IBM wasn't really too famous right now in major areas of technology, so they tried to remind to the public themselves. The U.S. ambassador to Britain officially launched the ship, and that was in Plymouth. There was wooden vessel with the same name as the one that was sent 400 years ago. I don't know how many of you remember the history of Mayflower, but it's a famous name and a famous word. The thing is that this ship is going to be artificially maneuvered, so there will be no control of it. I mean, we could control it, but we don't want to. We want to know how the artificial intelligence will behave during that trip. The ship is for 50 foot trimaran, so it looks like, I mean, Dr. Roy, if you could look at the, it looks like a spaceship. I mean, not a spaceship, looks like a extremely modern catamaran. So it's called trimaran because it does have a three floating platform. It's not a platform. Dr. Roy, you would be able to describe it better. Enter it here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll post a link, but it's a trimaran. You could look that up. You could Google it. It's basically two side pontoons that provide buoyancy and some stability. And the middle portion is the boat proper. But I hope people know the Mayflower. But then I also hope that they also know about the Sleepwell. Do you know about the Sleepwell, Wesley?
I know that it's ringing somewhere, but I don't know where.
Yeah, the Speedwell was another ship that took off with the, took off from, I think, Plymouth with the Mayflower. And they both apparently leaked like sieves. So they both had to go back to Plymouth, England. And the Mayflower was repaired. They decided that the poor Speedwell just wasn't up to repairs, and it never got a second chance.
Okay. The last one for today. The brain reading computer code is not the same as reading language. So basically, it is the statement in the science world that the brain reading computer code could and is ready to learn programming language at any age. You are never too old and never too young. So they were trying with 3 years old, 5 years old, and 80 years old. But it is new language. I can allude to the beginning of human race, and that was in the time of Neanderthals and primates. And the most used at that time language was battle language. So all animals belonging to group mammals, which human belongs to, were using the first form of the language, and that was battle language. And gesture was a little bit modern at that time form of communication, so that was a higher level of the language skills by the human being at that time, or pre-human being at that time. And then they start to use, because monkeys or apes, they have a hand, so they are able to use the gestures, and they use them, we can see them. So there are two schools of thought reading the how the brain learns code, or whatever the form of the communication. Music is beautiful language. Music is absolutely amazing language of communication. We have the highest skills possible professionals in this area. And interesting is that there are some groups that are able to communicate between themselves using music because they are skilled in that language. So in other words, is if I can understand 27 of Slavic languages, but I can speak three of them fluent, and plus that some of Hebrew, some of Yiddish, and some of English, probably some of German, because it's related to Yiddish. It is nothing special. It is just that in the Slavic languages you could learn three languages, and all of them are alike, so it's easy. Anyway, coming back to the subject, so there are two schools about reading how the brain can learn code or whatever the language. One holds that in order to be a good program at programming, you must be good at math. The other suggests that because of parallels between coding and language, skills might be more relevant. So to shed light on the issue, the researchers set out to study with the brain activity patterns while reading a computer code would overlap with language related brain activity. The two programming languages that the researchers focus on is the study that are known for their readability of Python and Scratch. JR Python, I was trying years ago, but I wasn't really interested too much. So that is also interesting how some of the computer programs teaching you languages could enhance your ability to speak other languages, or actually make you not interested. So those two visual programming languages designed for the children of age of 5 or older, and the subject in the study were all young adults proficient in the language they were being tested on, while the programmers rely on functional magnetic resonance fMRI. Well, I'm a little bit confused when they say fMRI. MRI, yes, it's NMR. It's just that the new word for it. So they're talking about functional magnetic resonance fMRI scanner. The researchers showed them snippets of code and asked them to predict what action code would produce. The researchers saw little to no response to code in the language region of brain. Instead, they found that the coding task mainly activated the so-called multiple demand networks, which network was whose activity is spread throughout the frontal and parietal lobes of the brain is typically recruited for a task that requires holding many pieces of information. Holding many pieces of information in mind at once and is responsible for our ability to perform wide variety of mental tasks. But more of it is in the article that Dr. Roy put on his web, and that's the article from MIT, and a number of researchers, surprisingly to me, a leading number of researchers are Russian over there, but they are American Russians. Anyhow, Dr. Roy, any comment?
I guess so. I have a bunch of bones to pick. Although there have been studies to demonstrate that gorillas can communicate using sign language, it is probably not a good idea to conflate that with that gorillas millions of years ago communicated with something akin to similar methods. Unfortunately, there's no way to backtrack and find out if gorillas and chimpanzees are communicated by body language. I don't know how you can kind of do that as a basis of anthropology or archaeology or such. So that's one thing. I think computer programming tends to not be equivalent to language. Personally, it to me is more of a mathematical and logistics phenomena in that the terms and the usage of the terms is incredibly collapsed and limited in programming languages. The formats are relatively simple and relatively easily understood, and it's the connecting the logical blocks of it that make or break a program. So I could sort of understand where a functional MRI would light up in a completely different place than speech centers.
Could you specify a little bit more accurate, more exact, the last, what you said?
Well, I don't know exactly how you want me to do more exact. This is just kind of off the top of my head because I haven't had quite a chance to read the entire article while you were talking. I was listening to you and doing some other things simultaneously. But nevertheless, I could sort of understand why they did not pick this up as a language, because there is a lot of dynamics involved in language that doesn't, to me, parallel what goes on when you program. I've done some programming. I've experienced the joy of trying to figure out how to get it to the computer to do the things that I readily wanted it to do and get it in a form where it could understand it. And like I said, it's more of dealing with mathematical concepts and logic concepts as opposed to the order of things and the form of things. You know, you don't really have to conjugate anything in a program, thankfully, whereas there's a lot of conjugation. And if you take Latin, there's a lot of other things that has to go on. So I could sort of see where you could see a similarity, but ultimately under the hood, I could see it coming from a completely different place.
Yeah, I have a comment on body language. It's like humans use the range of nonverbal communicative social skills such as facial expression, eye, gaze, and manual gestures, and tactile signals such as grooming and hooding. There is a negative language of gorillas having a higher hierarchy in the group that is manifested by body language. So sometimes turning on a side or showing the back, and that those are the gorillas by the language gestures. Let me drop it. So this is one on, we're on gorilla by the language. One way you can tell when the gorilla is beginning to get annoyed is when they tighten their lips and puff a little air in their cheeks. They also get a little stiff and straighten. So there are plenty what I would say is body language was the first primitive form of communication of the language, and then there was in reach of the gesture as more advanced form of communication. That would be in regards to what you said about the body language and tool chain.
Paul, please. We'll get to Paul in a second. I just want to point out that animals regularly communicate information between each other. They do it through different methods by evolutionary development. Insects do it by often by sending out chemical signals. Bees can explain to other bees the location of a bunch of flowers to be harvested simply by doing a little dance. So a lot of different animals that never evolved to having proper speech do have methods to convey information. And I think at this point, Wesley, you need to put a bow on it so that we could move to Paul.
Yeah, thank you very much, Roy, and the audience. I mean, I'm willing to continue this panel if it's interesting. If not, then we're gonna just stop to do it. What actually makes me to feel discomfort is some of the gentlemen not giving the call sign and saying, especially for these or whoever these. Let me jump. I do respect everybody, but also I have a little need of respect me. So maybe we can start a little bit earlier based on how many minutes do I have for a given point if you think that this is interesting panel. So this way we don't have the aggravation of some of the guys not having a call sign, watching TV on the sofa, and complaining about the weather, and sometimes pushing the microphone saying, a space report please, give me a call sign, sir, and to exit.
Well, as I suspected, silence. Well, what can I tell you? My parents taught me to be more polite than, I guess, other parents. Wesley, I want to thank you for your participation tonight. And you brought up a whole bunch of different topics, and that's fun, and I hope people enjoyed it. And I thank you for your participation. I thank everyone who came before for their participation. I want to remind people that if they have any questions or topics or comments or puzzles, or they want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I put up a whole bunch of links of articles that Wesley was talking about. And you can find them at roy.ac2gs.com. And I want to thank everyone again and bring on Paul WS2N with the Space Report.
AC2GS, WS2N. And very good. Well, we're ready with the Space Report. Of course, this is the technical matter. Somebody had a technical question. You just, when I NK, you could bring it up. There's no reason we can't go back to a question that somebody might have forgotten that might have come to them later on in the evening. Anyway, we're getting toward the end of the year, and they set a record for launching rockets so far out of Cape Canaveral, and Vandenberg F, what phase? Kodiak. There were 31 launches this year, and two of which are occurred at the beginning of this week and yesterday by SpaceX. They launched most of the rockets. They're just doing terrific with their reusability capability. They launched last week. They launched their rocket to the one I just saw yesterday was very good. The NRO, National Reconnaissance. The NRO is a government agency where they launch spy satellites, and that was a nice one. That went up yesterday in the afternoon, where it sent the rocket to geosynchronous orbit, and the booster came back to Cape Canaveral. That's always something good to watch. And of course, you can always bring them up on YouTube. They've done them countless times now. But successfully launched the rocket. It makes a U-turn up in space, actually, above the common line, using it. With the engines looking down, and eventually they launch. They light three more engines as they're coming into the atmosphere, and they keep coasting all the way down using these titanium fins near the top of the booster it picks up the air, and it's able to maneuver itself right on the money. They have a landing zone in Cape Canaveral called Landing Zone 1. SpaceX had to come down right dead center. The engine lights one more time. The four legs open up. Each leg is about 30 feet long, so about 60 feet from one end to the other. And landed dead center. They'll be able to reuse it. The launch they had at the beginning of the week, that had seven boosters that had times. And this one was the fifth time that booster was sent up. So they've really driven the price down at SpaceX. And that's the story with that. Setting a record next year, maybe they'll do the same thing all over again. Most of the rockets that went up this year had to do with the broadband system that SpaceX is putting up. A couple of other companies are trying to do the same thing as well. They have over 900 satellites up there. At least once a month they're trying to launch another rocket with 50 broadband satellites on it. Actually, over time they're going to eventually need 1,400 for operation, and they plan on doing even more than that, thousands and thousands of them over the years to come. So, let me drop it. They started out as a small company, 2002 or so, trying to get off the ground. It took them three shots they had three shots from an island out in the Pacific, Kwajalein Island. Then he had enough money for one more shot. The first three failed, and then the fourth one made it to orbit, and that was it. He was off to the races. There's another company that's trying to do exactly the same thing right now. There's a couple of companies, but this one is getting close. The name of it is called Astra, and they've been trying to launch out of Kodiak in Alaska. They call it now the Pacific Launch Port, Pacific Spaceport Complex, and it was always called Kodiak, so I still call it Kodiak. And they launched a rocket there this week. stable launch for him a couple of months ago, and it failed. It didn't make it to orbit. This one didn't make it to orbit either, but at least it got to the second stage, and they just didn't have enough fuel to make it to orbit. They did send some pictures back down. But if they could do it, it would be another small company called Astra that would be able to send up small satellites. They have a similar system to what Rocket Lab uses. Most rockets have these pumps that are driven by turbines that are usually fueled by the exhaust or pre-ignition type of thing with the rockets themselves. You know, you have essentially the flow of the gas from ignition is spinning up these turbines, which spin the pumps. Rocket Lab and now this company, Astra, have a different system where they use electric motors to drive these turbines, to drive these pumps. And they have batteries, lithium-ion batteries, that are able to do that. With Rocket Lab, they have 9 separate motors that are doing it. They're called Rutherford engines. They named it after Rutherford. And this one has 5 Delphi engines. And it was successful. They launched successfully and almost made it to orbit. So that'll be another one. There's so many of them, small rocket companies. Have a 747.
Question, KC, want to see him?
Okay, good evening, Sam. Above the common line, so... Their goal is to go to a polar orbit. That's why they launch out of Vandenberg, California, too. When they launch out of Vandenberg, they launch due south. First piece of land they go over is Antarctica. And the same thing with Kodiak. They don't go north, they go south. Same type of thing. They Pacific, North Pacific, South Pacific, and then over Antarctica. And polar orbits are very important to the surveillance. You might get into a sun synchronous orbit where, you know, every 24 hours you want to be back in the exact same location, you know, because the sun's just right and the shadows are just right, and you can compare, you know, have AB photographs. That's why they do that. If you're going to geosynchronous orbit, or you're doing flights to the space station, yeah, then you take off out of Florida. And, you know, you don't require that polar orbit. Back to you, Sam.
Gotcha. Casey, when I see him, back to you.
Not too long ago, SpaceX did launch out of Florida. First time in, I think, 40 some odd years that they did this, and they went due south, you know, over Cuba, and they launched a satellite for Venezuela, and they were allowed to do that because of technology. They have these new systems and the newer rockets like SpaceX, where if it starts to go off course one way or another, it'll blow itself up. Where the old system was, you would have people on the ground, and they'd be watching the radar, and the radar tells them, okay, you're going off course. They would hit a button and detonate the rocket, so it's in a populated area. But now they have it set up inside the rocket itself, where they can do that. And that also allows them to do, like, multiple rockets at the same time or land them at the same time. When SpaceX launched the Falcon 9 Heavy, that's, you know, Falcon 9 with two Falcon 9 boosters, one on the port side, one on the starboard side, and they launch anywhere, really. The ones that they did were launch out of Florida. They've done three so far. When they go up and the two boosters are coming back to land back in Florida at the Cape, those two boosters come down at the exact same time. Difficult for the people on the ground, even with the big antennas, tracking them, two of them on radar, and it would be too easy to foul up. You might blow up one and the other one might go through, and you really wanted to blow the other one up and the other one come down and hit a condominium or something. So with these separate independent installed systems that they have on the rockets, they can do that now. But on the most part, if you're going into a polar orbit, they will launch out of Vandenberg or out of Kodiak. Let me drop it and I'll go on. This is WS2N. Let me drop it for a long pause just in case an Echo Link guy is out there that wants to get through. Let me drop it. Nothing heard. Got an ID anyway in the Selden machine. That came through. Okay, a different topic. Perseverance is the name of the 2020 rover that's on its way to Mars. At this time, it's well over halfway there now. It's actually getting pretty close. It's got a landing date of February 18th. And that's this big 2,200-pound rover, similar-looking, similar weight to Curiosity that's been up there since 2012, still operating on Mars, and this one's going to join it. And on February 18th, they knew from day one it was going to land on that date. They know exactly, where they're going to go, a place called Jezero Crater, and that's where they're going to do their science once they do land. Anyway, when NASA does the coverage of this, they bring the media in. If you saw the landing of, let's say, Curiosity, the last one back in 2012, the place was crowded with media. I mean, they were arm to arm, camera to camera, and with the large crew, working on it. At that time was the 2012 rover, which is Curiosity. Now you can't have that because of the pandemic. So NASA has told the media, basically stay away. Maybe we'll have one or two cameras, and you can have a feed, and that's going to be it. I don't think there's going to be all that much coverage. Well, you'll have to look for the coverage. National Geographic will have something. Nova will probably do a documentary on it. They usually do. On PBS. And I'm sure the news will have some information. But it probably won't carry enough details, They might talk about the helicopter that's eventually going to be released from the rover. But they're not going to go maybe into fine details of the MOXIE unit that's making the oxygen on that rover as an experiment to see if they can do it. Well, a lot of the other technical things that are involved with the rover, the wheels, how they work, the rocket system, we'll cover it here on the net from week to week, and especially during that week when they land on February 18th. So at least anybody listening to this repeat will be able to get some detailed information from us on the net. And that's Perseverance. Hopefully that goes well. That was launched back in the summer on an Atlas V rocket. And it's been on the way ever since. Doesn't have an orbiter attached to it. It's just going to go direct landing
it'll come flying through the atmosphere with a heat shield looking down, and then one big massive 70-foot diameter parachute that will open up, and that will be attached to a sky crane. The sky crane will still have a rover attached to it. As that gets closer to the ground, the heat shield will pop off. It won't need that anymore. And that will expose the rover. It'll expose the radar, LIDAR, laser range-finding apparatus. It will be able to tell how far it is off the ground. And when it gets within, I think, 5,000 feet or so, parachute will completely disconnect, and this landing crane system will come on. It's got, these eight rockets that will be firing, slowing it down a bit, even. The cable with the data cable also attached to it. And then that. Sky crane will sense the change in weight when it touches the ground, and when it senses that change in weight, it will know to shut its engines off. And at that time, the pyrotechnic devices will fire, cutting the cables, cutting the data cables, and the rocket itself will fly away. Correction on that, it's the timing. When it hits the ground, the cables will cut and the rocket's engines are still firing. And it'll pull itself away and just leave the rover sitting on the ground. Slight correction there. But we'll go over all of this. They call it the EDL, Entry Descent and Landing System. It all takes about 7.5 minutes from when it gets into the atmosphere until landing. So that should be interesting coming up in February. There's a couple of other Mars missions on the way to Mars that will launch around the same time. One by the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, that was launched. They used the Japanese. Rocket doing the same thing. The Arab rocket is the spacecraft will just go into orbit, and the Chinese one will have an orbiter, a lander, and a rover, small rover. We'll see how that goes. Let's see if there's any questions or comments. This is WS2N. Okay. There's another company called Blue Origin, which is owned by Jeff Bezos for Amazon, and they have a rocket company called Blue Origin, building these New Glenn rockets. And one of the earlier flights, or many flights that they're going to be doing, will be similar to what SpaceX is doing. SpaceX is putting up a broad band system with their SpaceLink. They call them SpaceLink satellites. Literally going to be thousands of them. Well, Amazon will be doing the same thing. They have the Kuiper. Now they have none. But to get ahead of the game, they developed an antenna that will be able to be used for home use. You put it in your backyard, attach it to your house, and you'll be able to communicate with these satellites. SpaceX has come up with one for theirs, and they think it's around $500, but they said the real price would probably be about four times that price. But they might have to eat that price because nobody's going to pay $2,000 for a satellite, or for a satellite antenna. But Amazon has come up with this other design, which is around a foot in diameter compared to... what a small loss will look like. I had a picture of it. Actually sent it over to Dr. Roy. What the inside of it will look like, in short covering. But essentially they have two mesh antennas, one on top of the other, like two doilies, but one on top of the other, one, let's say, 8 inches in diameter, and the other one 12 inches in diameter. You'll be able to get two frequencies out of it, two different frequencies out of this antenna, and you'll be able to control them electronically, so they're phased array antennas. And, you know, the arm owner won't have to do anything, but it'll be all automatic. It'll know where the satellites are, and it will direct itself toward those satellites as they go overhead. But the design I came up with, apparently they got a patent on this. I mean, one is actually sitting right on top of the other. And I guess they have a substrate in between it, insulated. And they'll wire it up for Ka band, which is, you know, roughly 26 gigahertz up to 40 gigahertz. So it's a big area between that, you know, between that 26 and 40. So they don't need to have them on separate bands. It's actually within the same band, but one will be a transmitting frequency and one is a receiving frequency. So you'd be able to transmit up, I think, around 400 bits per second, megabits per second, and then down the link on the geosynchronous satellite. And that works. And this will be very inexpensive for the customer. The problem is they won't start launching probably for at least probably another year and a half. They'll start putting these satellites, the Kuiper satellites, in orbit, and they won't finish for probably a all right, thought I'd bring it to the net. So, interesting design. It makes me wonder if you have something similar that use it for maybe some kind of satellite communication. Easy communications with, let's say, with the space station or something. Anyway, any questions or comments? WS1. All right. Go over a couple of the little topics that I missed last week. I wanted to talk about Chuck Yeager. He had passed away. He was, I think, 97 years old. You know, I'm sure most people know who he is. He's the first guy that broke the sound barrier back in 1947 in October 14, 1947. And he flew the Bell X-1. Got it past Mach 1, and as time went on, he eventually was able to fly even faster than that. But he held a record. He eventually worked his way up to almost 2.5 Mach, 2.5 times the speed of sound. We lost a good guy about a couple weeks ago. I wanted to bring his name up last week, but I never got to it. That's pretty much it on him. Okay, and then there were a few other little topics last week, but I don't really think I'll get to that. You know, the Hayabusa topic, I've covered that. Hayabusa 2 with the sample return, I think I covered that last week and the week before. That's the one where Japan brought back the sample from Ryugu asteroid. And an update on it is they collected a lot more sample than they thought. They were happy, you know, with a small amount. They wind up with a lot more than they thought.
And some of those samples will be going to NASA. NASA helps them with some of the instruments on board. And that's the way it works, you know. When we bring our samples back from Bennu using OSIRIS-REx, we have different countries that we will give samples to as well. Let their scientists investigate that. That's the story. I want to bring those couple of stories up from last week. Let me drop it. All right, another topic we've covered quite a bit was the James Webb Space Telescope. I know Dick loved that conversation with K2RIW. And that's the space telescope that will be going out to Lagrange Point 2, which is a million miles away from Earth. So it won't be orbiting Earth, it'll be just sitting out there orbiting the Sun, just like the Earth orbits the Sun. So it will always be in the shadow of Earth. And speaking of a shadow, it's got this massive heat reflecting system that's going to unfurl as it's on its way to that Lagrange Point 2. And the idea is to unfurl this Mylar setup. It's got five layers, and it's as big as a tennis court. So this telescope, which is really an infrared telescope, so look at the temperatures, extremely low temperatures that you wouldn't normally receive. It's about a million miles away from Earth with the sunshade, so that the sun's heat, even the heat from the reflection of Earth and the heat from the reflection of the moon, can't affect the telescope itself. The telescope itself has a diameter of 21 feet. And that's going to all open up as well on the way to that location. This will all be launched toward the end of this coming year, 2021. It was supposed to be launched originally in 2017, but they've had so many delays, and it's cost a fortune, billions of dollars extra to compensate for all these problems. One of the problems was opening up massive sunshade that's as big as a tennis court. They tried it a couple of years ago, and very thin, all these different layers, five layers, and some spots had ripped and everything, so they had to correct all that. They finally did, and they opened it all up about a week or so ago. They finally got it all open. In a gigantic weatherproof laboratory. And they tried to even duplicate no gravity by having everything set up, all kinds of devices, all kinds of cables and things to try to make this thing like it was flying through space. But everything opened up 100%. Now you put it all back together again and have to fold up the telescope itself. It's 21 feet in diameter, so that will have to be folded up and then eventually put inside the fairing of a Ariane 5 rocket that will be launched by European Space Agency down in French Guiana. And like I said, all these countries have deals with one another. They all want a piece of the science, and for the European Space Agency and their consortium of around 20 countries to get any information, they're contributing the launch. So we're not paying for the launch, but we paid to build this whole thing. Other countries pay for certain parts of it as well. But it will launch out of French Guiana, out of South America, and hopefully within a month after launch, it'll get out to its Lagrange Point 2, and by that time, everything will be deployed. I think there's something like 80 different pyrotechnic devices, things that have to move, countless motors, all kinds of relays, and everything it's going to all have to work perfectly. Hundreds of different sequences have to take place in order to do this. So, if you bring up James Webb,
you know, animation. Put that into the computer, bring it up on YouTube. You can see this origami type of setup that's going to occur end of next year. Any questions, comments? Question. I heard a station. I'll stand by.
Yeah, this is Hank N1YDY, and my question is, why has this been delayed as often as it has? Was this a launch window availability problem, or was this an issue with getting the thing to work right?
That's the latter, Hank. Just trying to get it work to where it worked right. All kinds of problems. Like I said, the main problem was trying to open it, have this thing open up. And if you look at it, it's five different layers of this thin mylar type of reflecting surface. And from what I understand, that was the biggest problem. So, I mean, they planned on doing this back in 2017, so I guess it took all these years to fix it. And I guess they had another problem. They worked on them as they went. It's been, I guess, it's got to be 12 years now they're working on this thing. Thank you.
And that was my question. So thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, very good. James Webb was named after him. One of the early administrators of NASA. He really pushed for the Apollo program, and I guess they honored him by naming this thing after him. Okay, NASA has picked another crew for the third Dragon flight that's going to be going up. It won't go up until probably this fall. You have a crew up there now, and then you're going to have another crew going up. They have picked that crew. Two Americans, one guy from the European Space Agency, Germany. And then they put four people into the Dragon vehicle. And they haven't picked the fourth one yet. I think they want to try to get the Russians to go along with that. Russia,
that
right now,
is complete.
They don't want to fly on it. It hasn't flown enough. So they're holding off on it. But I think maybe that time frame, they might talk one into going up. They've done this type of thing before with the shuttle. You had Russians and all different people from different countries that flew on the space shuttle. And just like them, they've taken people from NASA on their Soyuz vehicle. And they've taken people from South Korea and Germany and Italy on their Soyuz vehicle. So it's truly an international effort when it comes to the International Space Station. And by that time, they'll probably have the Starliner operating. The Starliner is by Boeing. And they should be running another test flight to the space station unmanned, see if they can dock and spend a couple of weeks there and have the vehicle come back safely. And if that works out good, they'll be able to start sending crews up as well. They can also hold up to four people in their spacecraft. So, looking forward to the new crew that just got chosen. Eventually making their way to the space station. Talking about Russians. Russians have a new rocket that they've been dealing with called the Angara. Angara will eventually replace the Soyuz vehicle that they've been using like since the 1960s. Angara has different capabilities. So if you can run two or even four boosters attached to this thing, it's going to be designed to be able to carry not only cargo but crew as well. It's going to be man-rated. They tried to launch last 6 years ago with the inauguration of the Angara, and it didn't work out. Didn't make the orbit properly, so they did some reconfiguration, and they put it together and launched it from the northern part of Russia. put Beast, they call Beast launch facility. That's usually where they launch all their spy missions. They don't launch manned missions from there, but the Beast launch facility, and also they'll be able to launch from Boskochny.
KD2FRU?
Western, far western Soviet Union. Actually, it's not too far. So far from Moscow, that it's probably within a few hundred miles of Alaska. It's really not that far. And they've only launched a couple of rockets from there so far. But eventually, Angara will be able to do that as well. So they plan on eventually launching people from that launch complex. Their goal is to get away from launching from Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is, of course, now a different country. Soviet Union broke up, so they have to pay them hundreds of millions of dollars per year for that that launch facility in Kazakhstan called Baikonur. Baikonur is the same launch facility that the first guy ever went up, Yuri Gagarin. They've been using that ever since the man launch flight. That's about it. A couple more things here, but we could always cover this next week. We have holidays coming up. So I think I'll just turn it back over to Roy. And tomorrow is Monday. We have the Limark Club InfoNet.
KD2FRU.
You don't have to be a member. We'll turn it over to Roy. AC2GS, WS2N.
KD2FRU, question?
Question, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Hi, Paul, it's George. I got a question here. You were mentioning a few minutes ago about countries launching out of the northern part of South America, and we have always chosen our launching from the southern part of North America. Do the Russians have any advantage by launching, as you mentioned a minute or two ago, from northern Russia? Or is that the only way they can do it? Benefit, no benefit? Or does launching from any place on the planet help?
Okay, yeah, good evening, George. And when they launch from Pleiades, military launch facility, really, they launch north from there. And that's, I don't know if you, in the beginning part of the SpaceNet report, I talked about when we launch from Vandenberg, California, we launch due south, and first thing they go over is the Pacific Ocean. The first landmass is Antarctica, and the same for Kodiak up in Alaska. They launch due south, and they go into these polar orbits. When you're in a polar orbit, that's the best location for surveillance, either for props are doing, or checking the level of the water for climate control, but also for spy satellites. You could have these wonderful pictures of everywhere in the whole world by doing that. If you launch from, let's say, the equator, and there's you have land to the north or south of you, you can't do a polar launch, so you're pretty much restricted to east-west. Maybe from Florida, I think you can go up to around 63 degrees north inclination, but you can't make it all the way up to a polar launch. And the same thing with Russia. When Russia launches, they do all their polar launches from Pleiadesk, Russia. It's that further north, and they can go just directly over the Arctic Ocean, in that case, to get their polar satellites in operation. Probably mostly spy satellites, knowing them. And then you have Yeah, Baikonur, Kazakhstan. If you look at Russia, their landmass doesn't come that far.